Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams Podcast. Joining me this time is my good friend, Sir Stephen Wilkinson. Now, this is our second go around at recording this conversation because the last time we attempted to do this, I had an absolutely fascinating conversation with Sir Stephen, but the audio, for technical reasons, which we shan't go into, was completely and utterly corrupted. We spent about 2.5-3 weeks trying to get the audio in this kind of shape where we could actually listen to it because the conversation was so compelling. But eventually had to admit defeat. Stephen very graciously agreed to come back on and re-record the conversation. But what happened in the 2.5 weeks since we had that first conversation, the world moved on and we ended up having a completely different but equally compelling conversation about subjects that we didn't even touch on in our first conversation. So that first conversation will unfortunately remain between he and I, but I'm very happy to say that the rest of you will be able to eavesdrop on this one. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Sir Stephen Wilkinson. Stephen, welcome back to the podcast. I say welcome back, not just because you've been a guest before, but because you and I had an aborted attempt to record this conversation a little while ago, and you very graciously, thanks to some audio problems, agreed to do it again, which frankly astounds me. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And, you know, I've been thinking really hard about this, but there is no way on God's green earth that we're going to be able to redo the conversation that we had spontaneously a month ago. So
not a chance. That one dies with us. And it's a shame because it was a tremendously interesting conversation, as every conversation I have with you is. And I, for the benefit of the listeners, I spent a long time desperately trying to salvage the audio just to see if we could get even some of it up to snuff to publish, and it just wasn't doable. So
for my part, I thought I'd reread the transcript because at least I was recording it with a transcriber. And I think I must have had a Mongolian setting in there.
Oh, really?
I can't make out head or tail of what it was that we were talking about. So obviously that one wasn't meant to be. So I hope you have some apotropaic talisman protecting this conversation.
This conversation we shan't lose, I promise you that much. This conversation I am recording in two different ways now to make sure that we don't fall foul of the recording gods again, because that will be unforgivable. Well, listen, just before we press the record button, we were chatting offline, and I had to quickly stop you because it was, as it always does, it was getting so interesting so quickly. I wanted to make sure that we didn't lose that. And the subject at hand, which I think is a good place for us to start, was politics and was UK politics. And this is something that, you know, I've written about recently and fascinates me, not just as a expatriate Englishman, but also someone trying to see where the world goes from here. And I think there are all kinds of clues in just about every political outcome at the moment, because everybody's just about in the same boat. So let's begin with the UK. And we're a couple of months into a new Labour government. We're a couple of months into a government that was voted in pretty comprehensively, although when you dig into it, their support wasn't anywhere near as strong as perhaps the headlines would suggest. In fact, you know, they performed worse than the Corbyn-led Labour Party. And if you dig even further, you can find out that literally 20,000 votes cast here or there, and Reform Party being the biggest recipient of those votes, would have made the outcome very, very different. So I'm curious as to your thoughts on the outcome of the election, and then perhaps we could dig into what we've already seen in the first 8 weeks of the Labour Party's new term in office.
Yeah, it's interesting because we're both expats and we've both made fundamental life decisions not to be in our country of origin and be resident but non-dom somewhere else. And I certainly didn't make that decision for tax purposes. And when I moved to Germany at the age of 23, I think, nobody moves to Germany for tax purposes. No. And I think you moved to the Far East when you were around about the same age, and we were both in the same industry more or less all of our lives, but we've never made it back. And I think I've probably been back even less than you have, because Fulham plays more regularly than than the Lions do in rugby. And I don't have that much interest in football. And so it's easy to criticize from the sidelines. And I want to sort of put that as a disclaimer right at the beginning that, you know, it's very easy to sit in an armchair somewhere else and pontificate about the cultural evolution climate somewhere else. Because firstly, I didn't vote. I'm not allowed to anymore. I think 15 years, I was surprised. I haven't been in the country for 15 years. Your vote is rescinded. And so I don't have much skin in the game, if any, other than the fact that, you know, with a British passport holding and a life formative year spent in the UK, I still feel a very deep connection to my country of birth and origin. And I don't think that's something you can ever put to one side entirely. And there's always this question in the back of your mind, you know, when you've been wandering the globe and living in other cultures and climates, is there a time when you go back? Did the old lions return to the place of their origin and lie down and die? And so,
hopefully we're a long way from that, both of us.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. I very much hope I am. I'm certainly reading lots of books on how to stay healthy for a long time and realizing I've got a long way to go to meet up to those expectations. But you're quite right. I think this government was elected with the lowest share of the popular vote in absolute terms of any other government. And it's been said 100 times, so I don't really need to say it again, but this was not a Labour win. This doesn't signify a massive swing to more distributive Labour-like policies. It's not a vote of confidence in any of the personalities. It was a vomit outcome. And it was a collective vomiting out of the disgust of the electorate with the fact that the one thing that they sent the Johnson government with a thumping majority into Parliament to achieve, and I've always seen the Boris Johnson government as a wrecking ball. You know, he was elected to just do one thing, and that is smash his way through the opposition. Here's the biggest mandate since Margaret for a Conservative Prime Minister. Now just go and do this one thing and don't fuck it up. And of course, he didn't do that one thing anywhere close to the promise that he showed in that, you know, I keep thinking back to the Manchester speech where you thought, okay, we all know him for what he is, but he's at least captured the mood, which was always what he was quite good at. And so we now have a government that within, I don't know, 10 minutes showed its entire paucity of its intellectual ability, of its moral vacuity, of its what's the word, what's the phrase that I keep bumping up against? Bullying, moralizing, priggishness from the top down, and the dichotomy that is now sort of the face of British politics, that everything that is British is denigrated and everything that isn't is protected. And it, you know, it's a complete ass backwards situation, which is intolerable, you know. And this government has already shown its deep disconnection and loathing of the things that I think most British people find natural and didn't know they had to think about and defend. And at the same time, it's shown, I'm not going to say the idiocy because it's worked so well for so many hundreds of years, but the volatility that is packed into the British voting system, where you now have on display a massive disparity between what the people want and what they've got and what they get, and the power that has been mandated to a government that is plainly hugely out of touch with popular opinion and, you know, what the British public have thought they were voting for the past, I don't know, 15 years.
Well, it's been a fascinating 15 years watching the Tories, because where they ended up was a very un-Tory-like place. You know, we saw the fastest increase in taxes in 50 years, which is an absolute plank of Tory policy for since 1834. We saw a very weak hand on law and order, which is another plank of Tory party policy. We saw weakness on immigration. What we ended up with was not a Tory party. Hence, to your point, the vote, the people were absolutely disgusted with the fact that what the Tory party turned into was the antithesis of everything they were supposed to believe in. And I'm curious to get your thoughts on that, because it seems to me that none of those were necessarily choices made by the Conservative Party, but more the fact that the ability to enact proactive policy, given the financial constraints around most of these Western governments these days, means that whichever party you vote in, and we're seeing this with Labour already, that their first move was to follow their roots and give a massive pay increase to the train drivers, obviously, and that's let loose the horses immediately. And they're going to find the same thing. They're going to find that they're not in a position to do the things they need to do without counterbalancing the other side, which is going to mean significantly higher taxes. It's going to mean coming for all kinds of things that certainly were not on the radar of most English voters. So give me a sense of whether any party, we'll start with the UK and then we'll perhaps broaden that out, is in a fiscal position to govern in a responsible way, or if they just have to keep enacting policies that keep the lights on.
What occurs to me, or what I observe, and what is helping me with my thinking on that question, is why is a system of government that we thought had trumped all other forms of government, is what we call liberal democracy. So the idea that there is a fundamental acceptance of certain aspects of freedom, liberty, and individual responsibility, which are enshrined in the Bill of Rights, in the constitutional tradition of the United Kingdom, and that have been explored by the great philosophers of the Enlightenment for the last 250 years. So we have this idea of natural rights and a division of responsibility amongst the five pillars of the state, five pillars being Parliament, the judiciary, the police, the media, and the civil service, and that they were all truly independent of each other, and their job was to keep each other in check. And within that framework, that constitutional framework, and on the foundation of an understanding of liberty, and itself founded in the Judeo-Christian concept of individual responsibility, you know, starting with, we're made in the image of God, we're representations of the divine, and we get to choose between good and evil. And we're stewards of the world. You know, we've been given dominion. You know, we're general managers of the planet, having had that authority delegated to us on an individual level. And from that comes this idea of the sovereign individual, and the idea that we have to be held responsible for good and for making the right choices, but we are ultimately responsible for ourselves. And then we've evolved a system of government that more or less accepts that fundamental premise. And so what we're seeing is a deconstruction of the belief that we had, that was captured in Francis Fukuyama's End of History quote, which, you know, has been widely taken out of context, but he sort of meant, well, we've now figured out the system that works. We've had systems that violently go from monarchy or sort of semi-monarchy to authoritarian systems, and they come in two flavors. You know, the horseshoe, they're quite close at the end, full-on communism and full-on fascism. We've seen that they lead very quickly to economic systems that collapse under the weight of their own inconsistencies, because guess what? The only mechanism that we've ever found in human history that allocates resources efficiently is a free market in which prices are sending signals for priorities in the use of scarce resources. And we thought that with liberal democracy, well, we've found the way. You know, that's the only way. It's the end of history, because that's the only model that works. The only model that delivers consistent growth in productivity. It's the only model that allocates resources efficiently. It's the only model that guarantees human individual freedom. And it's the only model that works, evidently, and delivers the goods. It's the only one. And in, when was it, 1999 or 2000, when Fukuyama posited that, and we were all euphoric because every single one of these significant authoritarian non-market economy blocks had effectively worked themselves into bankruptcy, we thought, that's it. We figured it out. What none of us knew, because we don't have the history for it, is how do those systems, how does the system of liberal democracy evolve into a similar state of stasis and entropy? So what mechanisms were already at work in 2000 that were moving us into the same end game as those obviously faulty systems? We weren't looking at it. We thought we'd figured it out. And in the same way that every single business goes through three stages of maturity, which is the entrepreneurial stage, the production stage, and then the administrative stage. And the administrative stage, in conjunction with the productive stage, so the people, they're looking to hold the status quo in a constantly changing environment. And if you take the entrepreneurial aspect out of it, which is always disruptive, and what David Murren refers to as the lateral thinkers, if you deliberately take that out of the system because it's disruptive to the organization of production and administration, administrators and production people don't like things to change because, well, it's working, so don't screw it up. Unfortunately, it's that very locking in of production and administration into a system that believes that it's strong enough to overcome any external changes in the environment that kill it. And I think the same goes for countries and political systems as well. So coming slowly to the answer to your question, the fatal flaw of the liberal democratic system is that the power structures that don't like getting changed every 4 years or 5 years, they develop an understanding that actually the only thing that you need to control is popular opinion. Because it's popular opinion that if we manipulate it, ensures that the status quo remains more or less the same. So we'll have these things called elections, but behind the scenes, there is an atrophying and a concentration of power structures and a solidification and a drawing together of those five pillars, so they become indistinguishable from each other. And I don't think we noticed at the time, for 2000, when we thought we'd won, that we were already on an accelerating path to that solidification and lack of adaptability that was eventually going to be our ruin. And where does money come into this? And I think money is the central ethic. Guido Hussmann wrote a fantastic book about 15 years ago called The Ethics of Money Production. And if you think about it, if money is constantly being produced far more than the requirements of the economy itself to finance consumptive promises and redistributive promises that in the right narrative are perpetuating the power structure, well, then you are eroding the very function of money within a society, which is, you know, where all of us who are believers in hard money and the duty of those guardians of money to moderate their production, the production of that, in order to support the primary free market function, which is savings. You know, the generation of savings and the ethos of savings is a very bourgeois, fundamental Protestant ethic that says, if I deny myself today, if I deny my consumption today and save it for the future, well, there has to be some sort of guarantee that that bargain is being respected, that the money that I'm saving today is going to be at least worth the same as it was when I started saving it. And the great rotting function and the unethical flaw at the heart of the liberal democratic system with its fractional banking and control of money production is that it is built on the idea that you can keep robbing from tomorrow in order to fund today's promises and prosperity. And that eventually, as those of us who are in this conversation, and that's most of the people that you have interviewed in the last 100 years, however long you've been doing this, most of your guests, most of your commentators, the people that you hang out with, the reason that you are brought onto so many stages is because we know this to be true. We know this to be true. We know that the proverb of the ants and the grasshopper ends in misery for the grasshoppers. We know it. We're run by grasshoppers who are saying, okay, now it's winter, let's go and eat some ants. And unfortunately, it doesn't work because there are fundamental laws of economics that are as powerful and as strong and as irrefutable as they are laws of physics, because they are based on the immutable aspects of human behavior, that if you try to trounce them, but like putting pressure on a pressure cooker, you keep the lid on and just keep boiling and boiling and boiling, you'll blow it up. So the answer to your question is, eventually, if something can't go on forever, it will stop. And we are very close to the point where it goes asymptotic. Now, whether that comes through an inability of the monetary system to refinance itself because nobody's going to buy the stuff anymore, and the central bank ends up doing it, or we know how that ends by looking at the Weimar Republic or any other central bank monetization of government debt, which we're getting, or we're certainly at a point in the US where it's getting obvious that there's so much selling of treasuries, and the only real buyer in lots of auctions is going to be either coerced domestic institutions or the Federal Reserve itself. Once you're on that path, there's very little you can do to stop it. Now, I don't have the central banking and state financing expertise of Lacey Hunt or some of the other people, Luke Groman, on your regular list. But from an ethical perspective, from my understanding of how markets function and how money production works, the ethical flaw is what will bring it to its knees. And we're not far off that point. I don't know where it is. I don't know whether it's 180% of GDP or 200. But I remember Felix Zulauf about 2 years ago now, and I remember exactly where I was. I was just about to go up a mountain in the fog, and I sat in the car listening because I knew I was going to lose reception. And I sat listening, fascinated, when Felix said, in his understanding of where the world is going, this will end when the Federal Reserve has about 30 to 35 trillion on its balance sheet. And I thought, wait a second, that's 1.5 years worth of GDP. Where's he getting, that's just a made up number. But now you look at it and you think, okay, if that truly is going to happen and the government needs to expand as it does in any interventionist system. Mises wrote about this in 1955, and he gave a talk to the Union Club in 1955, I think it was, when he said, interventionism doesn't work. There's no third way. Once you start interfering in prices, the knock-on effect due to the extraordinary complexity of the information synapses in an economy means that you're going to have to keep expanding and keep expanding and keep expanding your reach to mitigate the consequences of the flawed decisions that you made to start with, which is why price controls never, ever work. If that is true, then it's easy to see that predicted balance sheet of 35 trillion, firstly, it's going to be in deeply devalued money, sort of Weimar type. It may not be Weimar type, but I could certainly see a position in which the Federal Reserve takes on, in a deep asset market decline, in which interest rates or the risk premium goes through the roof and there's a buyer's strike for treasuries. I can easily see the Fed having to mop up the entire banking system, funding the government for a year, year and a half, till they sort the crisis out. And it doesn't take long till you get to start from this starting point, another, I don't know what, 22 trillion, the year's worth of GDP. Easy, to imagine that in a catastrophe situation. And my suspicion is we're closer to that than we would like to believe. I just don't think we're there yet.
As you started that phenomenal answer, I was making a mental note to come back to money's role in this. And so I'm so glad you did, because again, you know, I think you and I have spent enough time immersed in the Austrian School of Economics and immersed in looking at the underpinnings of sound money and what that means to really everything, you know, and it's people kind of think of the world the wrong way around. You know, when you put money at the center, and by money, I don't mean paper notes, I mean money, wealth, savings, the things that you talk about in such justifiably hallowed terms. Once you do that and you spin the world on its axis, a lot of this stuff starts to make sense. But most people have grown up in a system where money is the end and not the beginning of the thing. Savings are, in some cases, the end, and some cases, superfluous and unnecessary. And the interesting thing, I think, for me is as we've gone on this journey and we've watched what the corruption of money and the corruption of interest rates and the corruption of savings has done, it's brought us to this point, but it's not just brought one country to this point. As we've seen in the past, you know, the Weimar Republic was an exception in and of itself, and it was a contained problem. We now have this kind of set of cascading situations where just about every one of those Western liberal democracies has watched the others do this so far successfully. And I put that in inverted commas, because success, if you think of the world in terms of sound money, is the sanctity of all the things that you spoke about. Success in today's world of Western liberal democracies is keeping the game going, is keeping the wheels on, is stopping that catastrophic moment where all the things you talked about reveal themselves. And so, you know, as we do move towards that, which we are inexorably every day, I mean, it's not, I don't think, something that can be avoided at this point. In terms of how those dominoes topple, in terms of whether we start to see smaller countries fall by the wayside and it infects the US dollar, or whether America has got itself in such a bad position that it cascades from the top down and the US is the first domino to fall, which seems to me to be unlikely, but it's not impossible. Which way around does this whole thing ultimately play out, do you think?
This is where an understanding of cycles comes in, because there is a rhythm, an underlying rhythm to human action and market behavior and to social mood, to borrow a phrase of Bob Brechter's from his Socionomics, which I'm slowly but surely getting my head around. We can talk about that at some time if you're interested. But what we leave out of this are the exogenous shocks that defy prediction, but somehow come along just at the time when the system is at its most fragile, and make an orderly management of affairs impossible. And it's usually one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. The menu is, you've got four choices with sort of sub-choices, and it's war, plague, natural catastrophes, and then the pale horse, which is always the sort of odd one that you're never quite sure what does that mean. But I think the pale horse was probably economic. It's man-made. It's the sort of evil in man. And so you can't predict any of those. I think they tried really hard to manufacture the plague bit that happened suspiciously close to that 2019 repo disaster that sent sort of shocks through the system, where everybody in the know, and I think you've written quite eloquently on this closer to the time, where people knew where to say the system's wobbling again, you know, which it tends to do mid-cycle. And so we've had a sort of manufactured plague, and we could see an awful lot of the mechanisms that were then activated, which for me personally, looking back on it in 2021 and 22, was the high watermark of international cooperation and the globalist system. That when we look back in sort of 50 years, and we know how this period has played out, we will look back to the COVID pandemic response coordinated across the entire globe as the high watermark of international cooperation. And so it might be that, I doubt it, because nobody's going to, people just won't believe it the next time. So it's probably going to be war. And war will be hugely damaging to the entire sort of Western self-confidence, because America is starting not from a position of strength, but from a position of great weakness and overconfidence in its definition of military prowess and strength. You know, it figures, because it's been spending so much money, the military oligarchs have found that the best margins are on, you know, the big, massive projects that nobody really understands how to account for them. Nobody understands the intricacies. You know, building a new hypersonic glide bomber is so much more difficult to figure out when the return on investment is going to appear than producing bullets. You can either you've got a warehouse full of them or you haven't, and you know roughly what they cost, and even a sort of relatively simple Pentagon accountant can do the math on that one. But a stealth bomber, no fucking way. You can't. There's no way to do that. You know, that's Parkinson's law at its best in that. But America is basing its military might on a possible definition of warfare in the 21st century that may well be seriously outdated, as we've seen in Ukraine, and possibly unfolding in the Middle East, that, you know, cheap drone technology can play havoc with extremely expensive heavy ordnance military infrastructure at, you know, a 20th of the price. And so my suspicion is that this ends through the inability of the United States and the total unpreparedness of all of its allies through years of anemic spending on their promised military expenditure. The Germans count, and most of the Western European countries count, the pensions that they're paying their military as military spending. You can do that, but it's not real military spending. It's not real defense. And I would argue that in Germany, at least, there is not one single politician, not one, nobody who has the faintest idea of what it means to genuinely invest in military capability for defense and offense purposes. Nobody. Because they've not had any practice. They're not even going really through a feet unbinding process, you know, that horrible ritual that the Chinese used to have of binding the women's feet in a state of tension that was sexually attractive for the men. And they thought also they couldn't run away. The same reason that the Swiss pulled the teeth out of the women in the villages in Appenzell, so that up until fairly recently, so that they would be, you know, useless for other men to want to take them away, which is a very odd way of. Anyway, so that feet unbinding process, which is agony, but necessary if you want to get your feet back. And if you look at the way that European defense is organized and the money that's being spent on it, it's fucking useless. They haven't even begun the process of decoupling and making themselves independent of the previous American military shield. And so if it happens, to answer your question, and I'm sorry for rambling around too and such, I think the cycle itself is giving us plenty of indications as to when this might happen. How it will then happen, I don't know, but it's going to be one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And from the timing, war is the most likely.
Yeah, and it's funny, everything we've seen, not just since Russia went over that border in a couple of years ago, but for many years before that, we've seen this escalation of conflict around the world. I mean, this really shouldn't be a surprise to people that we're creeping that way. But I just wonder whether it's possible today for there to be anybody in a position of importance in the outcome who has the right tools to deal with these problems. Because it seems to me that the system, as it has kind of withered away over the last 40, 50 years, gradually has driven out the kind of people that one would need to navigate this next situation. And it has attracted the people who believe in not the sanctity of all the things we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, but are conditioned to try and extract the maximum value for themselves out of the system. And the system, unfortunately, as it's evolved, has given them so many ways through which they can do that, that it seems to be that the system is almost trying to eat itself by bringing in the people who will ultimately bring it down. Is that fair?
I think that's absolutely fair. That's absolutely fair. And I think it's again, it's an innate part of how our system works. We've just never seen an entire cycle of liberal democratic political rule. We've never seen it. And we went from monarchy and church or semi-theocracy into a rule by a new aristocracy. So the monarchy in Britain, knee-deep in the period 1680 to 1710 in the United Kingdom, because it's such a fascinating period, you know, the end of the last third of Louis XIV's reign, the enormous pressure building up in Europe, the massive change in the UK or in England as after the Restoration, Charles II came back, the still simmering discontent between the previous Republicans under Cromwell and the monarchists, the Cavaliers, and then the tension Catholic and Protestant. You know, there were so many cross currents that, you know, when it came to the Glorious Revolution, Britain had already gone quite a long way into marginalizing the monarch and substituting parliamentary and civil service management of the economy. So we did it earlier, but everybody else sort of followed that, and it reached its apogee in the post-war growth of the managerial civil service and its sort of massive structures and interference in the economy. And I think what we're seeing is the two aspects of liberal democracy, one of which is oligarchic capitalism, and the other is the massive buildup of fiefdoms within government itself, making the elected representatives ever less powerful and the real power devolving to supersized institutions and supersized companies run by very much the same type of person. And they are largely interchangeable. And mediating the whole thing are supersized money production banks and the infrastructure that is required to manage them. So between the three of them, you know, the banking system and its central banks, supersized, massified businesses, and a supersized, massified bureaucracy, all of whose proponents and senior leaders, what we refer to as the elite, have very similar worldviews. It's almost religious in their, you know, the way that they seek to manage the economy. And so supersized business and supersized banking and money production, they know one thing, and that is that money corrupts always. So you just buy your way into these institutions, which is what we're seeing. They're buying universities, they're buying research, they're buying political influence, they're buying access to markets, they're buying freedom from prosecution, they're buying, you know, immunity to perpetuate the sort of nastiest side of what I like to call crapitalism, which is, you know, this system of massification and massive scaling, which the managerial class, James Burnham talked about in the 1920s, you know, perfect. And we're now coming to the end of it. So the more power that those structures have, the greater their corrupting influence on the free markets, the less attractive the role of leadership in politics actually becomes. So you end up with mid-witted careerists whose only real function is to serve within a party. And all of this plays sort of naturally into what David Murren. Have you talked to David Murren ever?
No, not yet.
I don't always agree with his positions, and he's very self-confident and robust in his opinions. But he does have a very powerful heuristic, and it's one that I've borrowed liberally from because the evidence points to it being true, or at least a useful heuristic for measuring exactly that question. And his heuristic is based on the idea that there are fundamentally two different types of thinking in people. There are linear people and there are lateral thinkers. And the whole world is dominated, or 80% of the global population is linear in its thinking patterns, which leaves 20% being lateral. Interesting statistic that I didn't know until I read David's work on the subject, that dyslexics are a 100% subset of lateral thinkers. So if you've got somebody who's dyslexic, who doesn't fit into the normal sort of school way of linear thing, and schooling is an education is 100% linear, designed for linear, it's designed for a linear outcome, it's designed by linear people for a linear audience. And it spits out and destroys the confidence of the lateral thinkers, unless those lateral thinkers are that very small strip, say 5 percentage points of the 20 percentage points, who have an above average IQ. Well, they can figure out how the linear system works because of their superior intelligence, play the game, whilst at the same time assimilating all the information they're getting into their multidimensional, holistic picture of the world. They're what David calls the hologram. So lateral thinkers are looking, and I suspect many of the people that you interview, and certainly many of the people who are attracted to you, will be on the lateral scale somewhere. They're thinking differently. They are thinking for themselves, and they're taking information from the engineering, the jobs that they've done, from their political observations, and they're creating this multidimensional map of the world into which they can fit information in a non-linear way that makes sense to them. And what happens is that the linears take the system to breaking point. Chamberlain, Neville, and his ilk were the ultimate linear thinkers, and it required an iconoclast, a deeply lateral thinker like Churchill, whose depth of knowledge on history, naval technology, political and emotional intelligence allowed him to synthesize all this information, recognize good and evil. Now, there's been an awful lot of talk about Churchill being the actual villain of the piece, and I don't know whether you've been following this this conversation that sort of evidently set everybody in a tizzy 2 weeks ago. And if that is true, then our current rejection of the quality of leadership, what we've just been talking about, the premise of your question was we're being led by numpties.
Yes, nicely paraphrased. And I should have just asked you that.
And of course we are. And the revelations that Keir Starmer's been sort of, you know, Frockgate has been taking money. Well, that's what happens at this stage. You get small-minded careerists suddenly armed with extraordinary power who think that that's due to they're being given a popular mandate. They're corrupt in a way that they think is just natural because they're surrounded by the corrupting influence of all these various rent-seeking monopoly massification in institutions, whether it's business or civil service or media, whatever it is, who are vying for maximum influence through their purchasing of political influence. And they lead the system to the point of collapse, at which point, when there's nobody else left, the next generation, the people look to the lateral thinkers, because they're the only ones with any ideas. They have a vision for the future. They've synthesized information, technology, an understanding of where we are in the arc of history. They've always personalities that never fitted into a linear system. So Churchill, as I say, Churchill is just a very clear example of somebody who, in the moment of need, was the one person who had a holistic view of the system and enough, I'm going to say, lunatic narcissism to believe what he was saying, that there was actually a way through. And it was just enough to keep the resistance hanging on. And he appealed, and I always found this fascinating, I don't know whether you've read Robert Lancaster's magnificent sort of magisterial three-part biography of Winston Churchill called The Last Lion. Well, he starts off with this superb insight, which was Churchill created an image of the Brit that did not exist before he articulated it, and for which he reached way back into a chivalric age to create this picture of the sturdy British bulldog, we're never going to give up, steeped in historical traditions of the Magna Carta and the Glorious Revolution, which he, and literally it was a Mr. Potato Head that he just stuck things in. And it was so flattering to the British, in the same way that Warren Buffett praises his leaders, his CEOs, constantly, because by doing it, he puts the public pressure on them to continue performing in honorable and deeply productive ways. So too did Churchill appeal to this English prototype, this typology that had never existed beforehand. It didn't. He created it out of a myth. You know, it wasn't all wrong, but nobody had synthesized this British spirit of resistance and fair play and in the way that he did. And we still cleave to that. We still think that's who we are because he told us that's who we are. And then we went out and did and behaved in that way, more or less. And then we won. You know, whether we won or not, or is it, you know, this is a moot point, but it felt as if we did. You know, it was, the economy was ruined and everything was bombed to shit and we were bankrupt, but you know, we won. And that solidified this sense of Britishness, which has been exported all over the world until everybody believes it. You go and ask anybody in Japan or in America what the sort of prototype of British is, and it's the Churchillian view of us. And we love it. And it still informs our sense of politics and fair play and how things should be, even though it's been deeply infected by and proven to be possibly not quite as heroic as we would like to think it is. It's still there in its substance. And these leaders, the ones who are going to lead us out of the fourth and into the first turning, they have yet to appear. They will be the marginalized older generation and the enthused younger generation who will come in into the hopelessness of the last generation of completely midwitted linear managers, you know, whether it's Rishi Sunak at the helm or Keir Starmer, or I don't know about Donald Trump, but I really don't, but definitely Kamala Harris. It doesn't matter which one of them is in the wheelhouse when we hit the iceberg. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because in a lot of conversations I've had recently, what you just articulated there at the very end is another synthesis of basically everybody's opinion, is that we know who everybody is in this except Trump. Trump is the one that isn't part of the system that created the Keir Starmers, the Rishi Sunaks, the Kamala Harrises. And his supporters will say that's a good thing. And he is there to shake the system up, and he's going to do it in a good way, an effective way. And his detractors say he's just a complete loose cannon, is the worst guy you could have in the seat at this particular point in time. I'm curious, with us being, 38 days away or 39 days away, maybe, from the US elections, I'm curious to talk about your thoughts on that, because we have, as I look at it, the choice is not a particularly good one. But I think for me, given the state of the world, and the state of America, it feels to me as though this existential tug of war over democracy, which this is being framed as, it feels to me, and I have difficulty articulating it, but I have to, that Trump is the better option, given the state of the world that we find ourselves in, given all the forces that we've talked about, all the climactic energy that has pushed us towards this kind of end of a huge cycle. It's somebody like Trump you need in there rather than somebody like Harris, who is a product of that environment. Would that be fair to say, or would you take a different path?
I think it is.
Yeah, exactly. I think too. I don't know.
The issue that we have with Trump is that he has almost no redeeming features. The establishment loathed Churchill. They loathed him for his pomposity, for his messianic belief in his own abilities, for his bravado, for his drinking, for his refusal to confirm. They loathed him, as they do Trump, they loathe him. He's not played the game according to their rules. But I find it very difficult. And so separating Trump, the person, from Trump, the policymaker, and his ability to smash through reform, it's really difficult. So what do I think Trump's most redeeming feature is? I think he is the only person in the world currently who can sit down with Putin and Zelensky and say, this is stopping now. So if he does that, if we sort of put the fire out in that particular theater of war, which, by the way, David Murren is, he'd go apoplectic. He's, for him, Satan, Putin is the great Satan, and NATO needs to put all its forces behind Ukraine and come what may. And so I find it difficult to follow that narrative, but Trump will stop it in its tracks. And he'll have to do it soon while he still has maximum political capital if they let him win. I also think that he's made a superb move. It was almost an unavoidable move. I think his hand was forced by Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy showed what an astute politician he is by maximizing his leverage at the highest point in the value of his capital, of his political stock. So he knew that if he didn't use it, if he didn't use his share price to cut a deal, it would return back to its to book value.
Right. Which was nothing. That's right.
So it's a little bit like there was a story going around about 3 or 4 years ago when your and my friend, who's been completely rehabilitated despite not having any incremental increase in his financial performance, the great Musk, there was a story, there was an idea going around that he would do a Steve Case and he would use his massively overpriced Tesla stock to buy a massively undervalued GM and create a, in the same way that Steve Case used his ridiculously overpriced AOL stock to buy Time Warner and get an asset-rich company but a poor performance with a, you know, and to use an asset-poor company to create one that was reasonably valued, but at massive advantage to his own shareholders. You know, that was the deal of the century. And I think that was probably the best deal that's ever been done for shareholders from a timing perspective. And so I think what that shows is that if you give Kennedy a brief on environment or health, and my personal belief is that the single largest and easiest bet economically, which I'm putting my own reputation and capital behind, is a massive change in the way that Americans understand healthcare delivery, and their own responsibility and the incentives created for living in a healthy way. So that's just as an aside. So he's now attracting people from all sorts of areas of the political church, all of whom have specialist expertise in particular areas, all of whom understand their brief deeply. Kennedy understands the corruption, both on the environmental side, the EPA, and the NIH and Fauci. He even wrote a book chronicling the deprivations of a mad psychopath in charge of the world, the largest economy's health system. Getting Tulsi Gabbard on, possibly to take on Homeland Security, which is another one of these vast areas that have sprawled out of control. So my sense is that the Trump who's coming into the 2024 election is a very different animal from the populist braggadocio of 2016 and the sort of revolutionary bad loser. And I'm not going to go into whether that was true or not, or whether Jan 6 was manufactured or not. We'll leave that to later historians. But he's a very different man. You know, he knows that by keeping his trap shut and by building a real team of experts around himself and using his own political capital, he is in a position to effect the sort of change that he thought he was going to be able to do just by bravado and tweeting in 2016. He's not a man of either the Republican or the Democrat camp. So he's Churchillian in that way. He has a sort of sly intelligence that is not profound. He's an awful rhetorician, just awful. But the mere fact that somebody wants to kill him really badly and not recognizing how much more popular that is, because at the very core, the American psyche has a lot of the British psyche. They don't like people being bullied and they'd prefer the underdogs. And, you know, they're quite happy with the idea of change at heart. So you tell me, I think for world peace, for taking us away from this manufactured and partially real antagonism, I have a feeling that he's probably the better candidate because he has the authority to do it and the others don't. And I think he has a better team and he's not a bloody Marxist or a woke commie stooge like the prospective VP. And I think Harris is awful. I think the regime that she represents is awful. And they've done enough damage, and it doesn't matter what comes after. As long as it's not them, it can't be worse.
Right, yeah. That's a very similar approach that I have to try to handicap the whole thing. Let me take a bit of a gear change, because, again, before we started actually recording, and I almost made the now common but fatal mistake of just getting so involved in a conversation with you, I forget to press record. You talked about an exercise you'd done for your kids, which, given everything we've talked about over the last hour and change, I'm curious to have you talk about that experiment and then go into the outcome of it, because I stopped you before you got into it because I knew it was going to be fascinating.
Yeah, well, I've been trying to understand the current situation through the lens of a number of different cycles. And my friend Akhil Patel, I don't know whether you've come across Akhil, but it's well worth interviewing him because he's superb, who I met through our mutual friend Tim Price in London, a number of years ago, he's a Georgian economist at heart. So he's a sort of well-versed in the philosophies of Henry George and his land price theory. And he's picked up on work that was done in the 60s, the 1960s, and then later on in the 80s and 70s by a couple of UK economic historians that identified a land price cycle, 18.6 years with basically 14 up with a 6-month hiatus in the middle and a 4-year down period. And I found that interesting. And when Akhil's book came out to last year, I was an avid reader of it. I'd love a more economic textbook, but as a popular book, it's beautifully written. And it sort of answers the question that the Queen asked in 2009, which was, at the London School of Economics, when she was opening a wing, she said, why did nobody see this coming? And nobody could answer it. And there's a sort of underlying 220-year history that has to do with the over-absorption of wealth creation through land prices and money creation, which works particularly in the Western economies, with almost clockwork-like precision. So I said, okay, if that is true, is that a reliable map for this particular cycle? It peaked 2008 in October. It finished at the beginning of 2012, which was when stock prices, and if you use stock prices rather than land prices, because they're a bit more difficult to measure and they're not as timely, so you can sort of translate it and compress it. But it's a good enough signal. It's a good enough. So if the end of the downturn is when you sort of retraced 50% of where you were beforehand, then beginning of 2012 is when it's finished. And if you add 14 years, you get to 2026. And if you put the 6 month in the middle, that gets you exactly to 2020, which was where we had a 6 month hiatus with, you know, the collapse of COVID and the collapse of the markets and then the recovery. Well, then we're sort of into the beginning of 2027. Now, if you then put that in the framework of the Kondratiev 56-year commodity cycle, which doesn't always align with the top of the land cycle, but this time it just happens to. That's not quite as accurate, but it's sort of somewhere between the middle of 26 and the middle of 27. So let's just say Q1 27. You've now got two cycles that are coming together. And if you then put that in the context of the generational cycle that Neil Howe refers to, the fourth turning, where he says it'll finish in 2033, that's his timing. He said, I'm not to a year or two. Well, that means that we're now well into the second half of the fourth turning. This is exactly what the fourth turning is supposed to feel like. And as I said to you, and I remember it's the only thing that I can remember from our conversation is, well, what the hell do you think happens in the last 7 or 8 years of the fourth turning? What do you think it feels like? How do we get from complacency to a whole generation wanting to rebuild broken institutions, which is the hallmark of the beginning of the first? What happens between now and then? And the only thing that can happen is destruction, destruction of wealth, destruction of property, destruction of borders, destruction more than anything else of complacency. Complacency has to die. But however that happens, none of us know, but it's usually one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse will be driving that change that leads us from entitlement to humility, from complacency to personal responsibility, from relativism to absolute values, from individualism to community. The things that are healthy in human society. And I hate to say it, from awful money to sound money. And somewhere between now and 2033, we have to get there. And the getting there bit in the last 5 to 7 years is never pretty. I don't know what not pretty looks like, but I'm damned if I'm going to get caught out by it. And I think that lateral thinkers who are able to contemplate possibilities outside of the very tightly defined Overton window in which we're all supposed to be thinking, that the state will have got everything under control, there is no need to panic, everything is being done in the best possible worlds, and that the people in charge are uniquely qualified to determine what is in our best interests and will continue to do that as they have always done. If you believe that, then when it turns out to be misplaced confidence, then the shock can kill you. It's as simple as that. The brokenheartedness that Admiral, what's the chap who, the Stoic in Vietnam and who survived by, just by concentrating on surviving every day, he said the people who died quickest were the ones who could not accept the change in their Admiral Stockdale. So they could not accept the change in their circumstances. They were free fighter pilots with the US Marines one day, and the next day were shot down and in a prison of wars in a hideous camp in Hanoi, prisoners of the Viet Cong, tortured, and they couldn't accept it. They didn't know what had happened. And he said, those of us who survived, we took on board our new reality very quickly, and we did not set a date for when we were going to go home. We didn't say we'll be home by Christmas, we'll be home by Easter, I'll be home by my birthday. Do that for 3 or 4 years and your heart is broken. You just die, you give up. And I think that that will be one of the lateral thinkers who emerge as leaders will be the ones who are already seeing where this is going. And they will be prepared, and they will be mentally prepared, even if they're not financially prepared, because we don't know what's going to happen. But at least they won't be totally surprised when the wheels start coming off.
I was in Montana this past week at a small event, which was fascinating and filled with some extraordinary people. And this topic came up a fair bit. And I ended up talking to some people about the idea of the fourth turning. I was saying to them that, look, it's a climactic event. So we're building towards it. So however bad you feel the last 10 years have been, or the last 5 years, or the last 2 years, or the last year, it builds to a climax from here. So we don't plateau here and then things gently fall over. This is going to continue to ratchet up, and it's going to continue to feel worse until it finally breaks, until it finally, those institutions you talked about are torn down, and that loss of faith is crystallized in a rejection of institutions and a rebuilding of new ones. But listening to you just talking then about
getting from here to there, it needs, for this climactic event to finally happen, it needs an ever-growing number of people to recognize this reality and to understand it and to realize that the change that needs to happen isn't, A, going to happen gently and it isn't going to happen without struggle.
I disagree. If you look at the people who are most vocal around this sort of end of the American empire, Ray Dalio has written a book, which I've got here, Changing World Order, in which he maps it out. And he recently came out with an essay, which he wrote, quoting from this, you know, there are only three choices, pick a side and fight, go into hiding, keep your head down, or run. He said, those are the only three choices. And what's our great friend, George Soros's trader, Stanley Druckenmiller, he's also been very vocal around, you know, it's coming to an end. And there are some voices, and Buffett himself is accumulating cash. Buffett says, we never time the market, to which I say, yes, you do. You know, over $300 billion in cash is telling me that you don't think there's anything cheap out there at the moment. And why would you be doing that if you didn't think that you would be able to deploy it, which is, by the way, the only way you're going to continue getting those outsized returns over time. So the signals are there, and there's an awful lot of catastrophizing going on because those of us who have been watching this for a long time are almost willing it to happen because we want to get it over with. I believe that the public or the general atmosphere needs to be extremely positive before it breaks. And so the warnings of Druckenmiller and Dalio and Buffett, and if he's still alive then, they need to have been forgotten. They need to have been forgotten in order for the thing to happen. I don't believe there will be a growing movement of understanding this is now gone too far. I think the signals will be far more confusing than that, and it will take us by surprise as tops and breaks always do, always. In 2008, it shook everybody to their foundations, and there were a couple who'd seen the housing market, but nobody was predicting the knock-on effect of that, nobody. Not John Paulson, not nobody. And so I think we're probably going to have a year and a half of 2 years of boom time. 25 and 26 are going to be, I think we'll see the Dow over 5,000. I think we'll see interest rates down long on the long end at 3, short rates back again. I think Wall Street will be in party mood. And it'll only be then, when nobody's expecting it anymore, when everybody says, oh yeah, those old men with their catastrophes shouting at clouds, then it'll happen.
See, I find that fascinating because if that is to be the way this plays out, I struggle to think about, given the fact of where we are now, and we are on a war footing, whichever way you look at it. We have a debt crisis that is manifesting. We have abject. We have all the things in place. When you think about it happening out of the blue, it needs to be something that triggers it, and we kind of have all those triggers in place right now. Potentially, you know, any one of them, the debt thing could go, the war could happen, the wrong leaders get in. All those things are there. So if we're to get through this to a time of boom or peace or anything less stressful than where we're in now before this falls over, how do we get through all the challenges we face right now to a brief hiatus before this falls over?
To quote Harold Macmillan, events, dear boy.
Events, dear boy, that's right.
Putin has a heart attack.
Right.
Xi is toppled. There's a popular revolution in Iran. Hezbollah collapses. Trump gets in on a massive popular vote that is unfalsifiable and seals a deal with Putin and just closes down the theater of war, and there's a Marshall Plan, or who the fuck knows? Events will happen that will put people in a false sense of security. That, oh, it's all going to be okay.
Of course, what you say is right. Events, dear boy, events is absolutely right. And any one of those things is perfectly plausible. But the one component of this, which brings us back to where we started, the one component of this that won't just magically go away...
Is the debt. But we don't know when that Hemingway moment...
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And even at 100 and... What is it? Where are we now with the US? 120?
123 or something, yes.
125%. We don't know whether it's 140 or 150. We've no idea. And we will keep testing that until we don't need to anymore. And even then we won't know, because it would be something unrelated to that that causes the current mechanism and distribution system and pricing mechanism to not function anymore. We never know. We won't know what the limits are, because it's not going to be the liberal democratic system itself that is extrapolated to its catastrophic end. It'll be an exogenous event that tests it and finds it wanting before that technically calculable endpoint is reached, or surmisable endpoint is reached.
Fascinating. Well, Stephen, I've just seen the time. I've taken way more of your time than I thought, which, if we put it on top of the last hour and a half, is an awful, awful big ask. So I'm incredibly grateful to you for your time and for doing this again. We had a completely different conversation this time.
We did, didn't we?
In every way, but it was equally fascinating. So thank you for that. And before we close, just tell people a little bit about, you know, your Substack and all the things you're doing, because I know from the last time you and I had a conversation, the amount of emails I got from people wanting to know more about you was overwhelming. So let them know, so save me having to type all those emails up.
The only place that I'm visible at all is through my my regular, and now slightly less regular,
Substack. I was just about to criticise you for that, actually. Yes.
Yeah, my Substack, which I published under the title of Pitchfork Papers. So it's Substack. I think it's goodandprosper.substack.com, which I'm changing to pitchforkpapers.substack.com. Or you can find me on the Good and Prosper website, which is goodandprosper.com, which is about to be relaunched on Monday. So wait for that. And otherwise, I am not on any other medium. I used to be on Twitter, but Elon Musk kept filling my inbox with his own tweets, and I got bored of that. So I'm not on that anymore. And he broke the link to Substack. You couldn't republish on Twitter anymore. So I thought, what's the point? And Substack is great. I'm just wondering when they're going to go for that, because it's such an amazing hotbed of critical, intelligent, long-form essay writing. I revel in the information that's available on there. And of course, you know, I find out what's going on in the world through listening to your podcast and reading your newsletter.
Nicely done, sir. Nicely done. Stephen, it's been a pleasure as always. Thank you so much. And hopefully the next time we chat, it will be in person over a nice cold glass or something.
Well, I'm going to plug your, I'll tell you when it's going to be. It'll be in Tampa on the 14th of November for the, what did you call it? A shenanigan? No, a shindig.
Super terrific happy day.
Happy day. Yeah. So thank you.
Fantastic. I look forward to it. Thanks again, my friend. I'll see you soon.
Take care.
Well, there you have it, folks. My thanks to Sir Stephen for joining me again and having that conversation all over again after the issues we had with the sound quality last time. Hopefully you'll agree with me. It was a fascinating and compelling conversation. Just a reminder, goodandprosper.substack.com. Or if you just search for the Pitchfork Papers, which will be the new domain title of Stephen's work, but Pitchfork Papers is the way to find him. And I cannot recommend strongly enough that you spend time reading Stephen's thoughts, because he is one of the most thoughtful, most erudite commentators on all kinds of things related to finance, economics, geopolitics, and business in the world today. Again, my thanks to Stephen, and thanks to you, as always, for listening. I'll be back with another guest in the not-too-distant future. In the meantime, as always, thank you very much for listening.
Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So, while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.